Speaking of On Another Planet, welcome back to another exciting show, ladies and gentlemen. I hope many of you are tuning in for more than one time just to listen to some of the amazing things that we get to discuss and talk about on this show. The kind of things that mainstream media just kind of doesn't touch with a serious tone, namely because it kind of distorts the current perception of reality, whatever that happens to be. Usually, it's quite an unreal sensation that things that you're doing actually mean something when they really don't, because they're trumped by a whole lot of other things that are going on that you weren't even aware of because you're too busy doing meaningless nonsense to notice. Welcome, everybody. So, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, my very special guest today is Andrew Bishago, and we want to be taking callers in the second hour. So if you are going to be listening into this show, we'd love to hear from you. The number will be 218-339-8525. Getting up those pencils and papers there, 218-339-8525. Okay, taking calls in the second hour. Andrew Bishago, welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you, Vinny. Thank you for having me.
Again?
Yes.
Was this like the third time we've had you on here?
It's number three. I'm not
mistaken. What attracts you back to the show so often, mate?
I think it's your generous invitations.
Yeah, my invitations are pretty generous. Speaking of which, I'm having a December 21st party. And if you could get access to the jump room, you know, one last time, well, if you just teleport over here tomorrow evening and have a few drinks with us or something at the end of the world.
Well, that would be nice. Or the beginning of the future.
Yeah. Well, if you notice, a lot of people describe the world as if they really know what it is, as if they've been everywhere on it. You know, the world is this way, the world is that way. Well, not really. And if you're talking about the end of a world, you're not even familiar with it. It'd just be the end of your small town, your meager existence, your social network and things like that, your Facebook. What are you really lost? Not a hell of a lot. But you got to really think about this. How is the world today? A lot of people, general awareness, especially on who listen to this kind of talk radio, will conclude that it's not a very good place at all. And things are getting worse. So ending it and restarting it, I've always said for a long time, Andy, we should just be pressing the reset button here. You know, just stop all of this, everything. Stop the wars, stop the politicians, you know, stop the Domino's pizza and the McDonald's delivery to New York apartments and all of the stuff. Just everybody just stop for a couple of days. Wouldn't that be nice to not have to worry about, you know, brutal, lying, sociopathic, dictating scumbags doing anything for a couple of days?
Well, I think most people are doing good things most of the time. I think it's the free rein that we're giving to sociopaths, which I think is an apt description on your part that we really have to examine. Why are we permitting sociopaths to run our planetary society? If not to run it, at least to be the dominant actors causing enough violence and fear to make it much less of a planet than it could be.
Well, where's the aspect ratio here? You know, how much power are you supposed to give these elected peoples? Really?
Well, it's not just the elected officials. It's also the misprision of power by individuals in the corporate sector, in the banking community, in the media as a fourth branch of government. But I do believe most people are good. I just think that we're in the thrall of a small group of very well-organized sociopaths.
Well, let's say it's the ordinary people who are doing good things every day that is actually keeping the evil at bay and preventing it from a total takeover.
Absolutely. That's my point. We despond regarding humanity, but I think humanity is actually a fairly good species. I think the problem is that we haven't gotten a rein on the pathology of human psychology. You know, even in psychology and psychiatry, we study the misanthropic or insane personality types, but we haven't even really framed a vision of what the oo-anthropic anthropomorphic or optimal human psychology is. I mean, we study the nuts and the violent and the sociopathic, but we, beyond a few models like Abraham Maslow's concept of self-actualization, we really haven't framed the psychology of optimal human consciousness, at least in psychology and in psychiatry.
You know, what's funny is we're always so interested to see what's the worst about us and our species, but we're too afraid to look at what's really best about us.
Well, we laud certain paragons of human virtue, like your Helen Kellers and Mahatma Gandhi's, but we're really hard-pressed to define what makes the opposite of a sociopath. What is it? What are the things that we should be emulating as individuals? You know, we lionize people and regard them as saints, but they were really just flesh and blood people like ourselves who chose to live in a humanitarian way. Now, what are the definers of that? How do you create people like that?
I was just thinking about that this morning before I came on the show, Andrew, and I was trying to define myself. Like, what's one of the aspects of the way I communicate with people? What makes me different? Why do I try and help people all the time? And I think it's because I've got an overabundance of empathy. You know, like I can't stand still while other people are hurting or suffering around me because I feel a little bit of that hurt and suffering, if you know what I mean. Maybe these people were like me. They simply got sick of suffering through, vicariously through everybody else's pain and went out to purge it.
Or even maybe they are you. You know, I remember Joseph Campbell's example of the policeman in Hawaii who jumped into the lip of the volcano to save the man who was going to take his life by jumping into the volcano. And they said, what inspired you to actually lunge toward this man and prevent his suicide? And the man was asked, was it because you recognized he was another human being? And the policeman said, no, I had a sudden flash of recognition that he was me, that we were the same life. And so he was saving part of himself by risking his own life to prevent this man from taking his. And I think we all have moments of that sense of cosmic consciousness where we recognize that we're one cell and 7 billion cells, as my mentor Norman Cousins conceptualized it. But the problem is we're not doing that all the time. And I don't think we'd be living in some kind of totalitarian state if we did. I think opposite of the case is the case. I think we'd be living in a functional Gandhian society where war would be eliminated and the economy would improve, people would be more cooperative and prosperous. Because look at all of the human endeavor that goes towards not just taking advantage of other people, but where good people engage in behaviors to protect themselves from bad people. You know, all the checks that have to be written properly, all the doors that have to be locked, and all the carnage that has to be cleaned up. I mean, it's a huge amount of human net economic activity goes to keeping evil at bay. You know, but if we could figure out how to cultivate a large population of Gandhian people, I don't think that would put us in some kind of totalitarian socialist nightmare. I think it would deliver us into more of a utopian existence.
Well, I had a conversation with a number of religious people these last few shows, and in one of the conversations, we talked about the sheep analogy. The people are sheep. They'll be either led by a shepherd into the slaughtered house, or they'll be led by another shepherd into greener pastures, you know, a Spartacus-type character. But generally, people do need leadership.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do on the transportation front, because if you're talking about behaving like sheep or even lemmings, as it were, jumping off the cliff, together, I don't think we can find any more apt example in contemporary society, certainly in the developed world, of the fact that we're all beginning to live in a dystopian automotive nightmare. I mean, every time a lane is added to a freeway in California, it fills up with cars 30 days. So one of the reasons I'm advancing my call for the United States government disclosing and deploying the Tesla teleportation technology that it developed going on over 40 years ago, and which I was utilizing as a child in Project Pegasus, is that we have to get a handle on the transport sector of society because we have seen the society at large behave in a very acquiescent way in utilizing and creating a burden to the environmental commons and to the economic activity of society by acquiescing in this automotive nightmare we now find ourselves in. I don't think anybody listening would want to, for example, in a major city, have to, let's say in a major city where they live, where there's a major airport, have to stay at an airport hotel overnight rather than their own home because of the difficulty getting across town the next morning to take their flight, to get across town via automobile. But that's the world we're going to be living in the lifetime of most people listening, unless we find a more efficient way to get people from point A to point B than planes, trains, or automobiles. And so what I'm advancing is I'm calling out to the United States government. In fact, I'm going to be seeking the presidency of the United States itself to get a handle on transportation and to implement teleportation. Transportation produces 60% of the greenhouse gases that embody the human contribution to climate change. So if we're going to make good and respond to Al Gore's position that we are in a climate change crisis, and I think we are, and I think it has both natural and human inputs, and I don't think we can debate that. I think it's clear that both, I mean, things are happening, like the whole solar system is heating up because of where we are in space.
Yeah. But well, I think the argument about climate change is kind of irrelevant because for whatever environmental good they hope to achieve from climate change measures, the only thing they're really proposing is just a tax on all human activity.
Right, and that's the old command and control model from the 70s. So there's my point about the fact that we're all acquiescing in the fact that we're stuck in the 70s. I mean, you walk into a family restaurant in the United States, I don't know how it is in New Zealand, but, you know, you hear James Taylor singing a song that he recorded 40, 45 years ago. You get into an automobile that is very little different than the automobiles that existed in 1970. They're still based on the internal combustion engine and the burning of fossil fuel. And the government leaders that are trying to get a handle on the human contribution to climate change are trying to impose, as you stated, basically restriction and taxation in a command and control model to limit our personal freedom to bring about.
Well, it's not just that. It's kind of stated that all these carbon taxes will be going to fund the setup of a world government that will be able to kind of completely control basically human interaction. Like, for example, Andy, can you name me a human activity from breathing to driving to manufacturing that doesn't produce CO2? I mean, the building of a house.
No. Yeah.
So what's the perfect thing to tax if you want to control all human activity and shut it down?
Well, that's a brilliant point. So there may be a hidden agenda of actually enslaving the human race under a world government.
And not to mention, it takes away from, say, the fluoride in the water or the other air pollutants and things of this nature. We're focusing on one small gas that is having an effect. Even the people who are anti-climate change and everything admit that the human contribution to CO2 is having a minute effect on the atmosphere. But the other things we're doing, polluting the oceans with radioactive waste and the enormous amount of plastics that are now floating in islands that are hundreds of miles wide in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic and off the Cape and everything like that. We've got a real environmental nightmare going on. You know, the air quality is the least of our worries. As far as I see it, because it's not killing quite so many people as the other things that we're messing up.
Well, I agree with your major premise. I mean, Captain Jacques Cousteau was once asked what he thought the most significant current environmental danger was, and he stated the prospect of a nuclear war. He didn't talk about climate change. He didn't mention biodiversity and some of the more trendy environmental concerns. He was concerned most by the possibility that the entire biosphere would be ravaged by a nuclear war. I do agree with your premise that certainly radioactive pollution is a major environmental concern, but I do think human contribution to climate change is more than minuscule, but I do believe that it also involves the net effect also of natural changes going on in our solar system. But I think the question is then, even if our contribution has a trim tab effect, we want to rein it in. Now, do we rein it in by oppressing people in a command and control model? Or do we rein it in through technical innovation that is literally available to us right now if the U.S. government will act to declassify teleportation?
Now, that's a brilliant point, Andy, because if we can come up with a technical solution to this problem that they're going to propose, the solution is just taxation and full-on control of the human race, that they got suddenly no argument. And we've suddenly got no environmental problems. Okay, have you noticed that all problems don't get solved by politicians? They get solved by scientists, engineers, people who actually problem solve.
Well, if we're going to save our planet, we're going to have to bring citizen statesmen and stateswomen into government because the solutions have already been developed. It's not a problem of science at this point. It's a problem of leadership and of declassifying the technologies that are already available.
Well, I was talking to a friend the other day, and they occupied a church talking about the Native Indians of Canada being enslaved and killed in the church schools, things like that. And they were all standing at the doorway, kind of afraid to go in, afraid to occupy this church. And given panic, he took the first step, second step, and suddenly everybody came in behind him and they occupied an entire cathedral while it was in full prayer. Okay? It does take leadership. All you've got to do is take those first couple of steps and suddenly you've got everybody behind you. Isn't that interesting? We'll be right back with Andrew Bashaga. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcast live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. And we're speaking about environmental issues in the background here and how teleportation could help with all of those transport needs. And you know what the other thing is? The production of oil produces so much pollution in and of itself. You know, we got the BP oil spill that we had to clean up, and goodness knows how many other tankers and Exxon Valdez and things like that have taken out and destroyed huge quantities of the environment all over the world. That's not necessary anymore. We've got the technology, you know. Oh, and the other major concern of mine is actually pesticide use. That stuff is rampant. It's everywhere. And apparently all the DDT blows up wind and it's settling around Alaska and northern Canada and the Arctic Circle and things like that. It's just unbelievable the amount of cancer and all that stuff that all these cumulative poisons in our environment are causing. There's lots of environmental issues, and I think we should focus on all of them, you know. Well, I mean, to be fair, the environment's pretty big and varied, isn't it? As being destroyed in many varied ways, too. Should be aware of all of them, as many as we can. Andrew Bashaga is my guest. And he's going to be running for president, running as an interdimensional in the next presidential election. And he's keyed to win. Welcome back, Andy.
As an independent, Vinny.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. Small words.
Yes, yes. Now, We wanted to talk about this this Mars thing, mm-hmm. And there was an argument that you guys had either gone to Mars or you'd gone to some kind of quantum synthetic environment or something. I don't know the details on this.
Right. In the summer of 1980, I was brought into my second period of service by the United States government when I was brought into a Mars training class that was held at the College of the Siskiyous in Northern California. The instructor was Major Ed Dames, and there were 10 young people being trained with three or four of our parents frequently present and auditing the class, all of them with ties to the Central Intelligence Agency. Five of the young people of that group and the investigator of the program have been identified. The five that we know were enrolled, besides myself, was a young man who had just done a year at Occidental College in Southern California named Barry Satoru, who we now know as the 44th President of the United States, Barack Obama. His mother, Stanley Ann Dunham, was frequently auditing the class. I was auditing the class with my father, Raymond F. Bishago, who was a special projects engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company of Pasadena, California, but who had ties to the CIA as a result of his classified aerospace engineering work that went back to the ramjet engine at Curtiss Wright in October of 1952. Most of what my dad did in engineering work was on classified defense work for the U.S. government with reporting requirements to the CIA and different branches of the U.S. military. Also in that class was someone who was somewhat younger. He was in his sort of early teens, William B. Stillings, whose father, Thomas J. Stillings of Lockheed Skunk Works, audited all of the classes, as did my dad. And we've identified two of the other, the five of the ten. They included Regina E. Dugan, who had just done a year at Caltech in Pasadena, California, again, after entering as a 16-year-old. She was the only girl in class. And then one of the future astronauts, one of the future space shuttle pilots, William Cameron McCool, was in our class. We haven't identified the five other young people. It's been over 30 years since that summer. But three of the individuals in the room have come together and confirmed our training in the program as well as our activities in the program that included off-planet activity. They were myself and William B. Stillings. And the man that the U.S. intelligence community had asked to investigate the program, and it was literally dropped into the program, both the training and then operationally. And that was the gentleman that you've had on previously, Bernard Mendez. Now, when we began consulting, sort of, you know, having kind of long Skype conversations with each other, going back over a year now, the three of us, Bernie, Brett, and myself, a kind of a legitimate scientific dispute began as to whether we were visiting Mars, basically the planetary Mars that we see in the night sky every 2 years when Mars comes close to Earth, or whether we were visiting some form of synthetic quantum environment. Now, that's a term that I've invented to describe the notion of an artificial holographic planetary domain that was Mars-like but not the actual Mars. The first position is that position that has been advanced by William Stillings. Brett is convinced that we were going to the actual Mars in real time. And I think some of the high points of his position are that we were trained for Mars, and certainly the people training us weren't aware of why they were training us or where they were going to be sending us. Brett has noted that when we were on the surface, particularly as the sky darkened as evening drew near, we could see that the Martian moons Phobos and Deimos were in their correct transits in the sky, the right direction, the right position relative to each other. And also, Brett recounted an anecdote in which he and Courtney Hunt of the CIA and I were standing next to the jump room building that we called the Corkscrew, because it had basically a conch shell shape. It was a spiral building that went down one story to where the jump room elevator was positioned, and then we would come out of the door and walk on an inclined plane for several turns up to the surface on that corkscrew-like ramp that made up the building. And Brett remembers, and I can certainly testify that he was accurate in remembering that Courtney Hunt once pointed to the middle distance beyond the corkscrew and informed us that the Viking 2 apparatus was about 20 miles distant. He actually pointed to its location. And Brett said,
"Sorry, what is the Viking 2?
Well, the Viking 2 was one of the early NASA probes that put a robotic object on the surface of Mars. So Brett was saying, look, this couldn't have been some hologram. It couldn't have been some niche in space. it had to have been the terrestrial Mars, because Courtney was informing us that Viking 2 was 20 miles in that direction. You know, just as if we were standing in Kansas, we could point to the east and say, you know, New York City is that, you know, in that direction. Fred's point was that we had to be on the surface of Mars for Hunt to be making reference to where this planetary, or, you know, interplanetary probe was located. Now, I think the best evidence for Brett's position is something else that he and I were able to confirm when we met up again after 30 years recently, which is that we both remember that in the fall of 1983, the program was telling us, get ready for a few more jumps in the spring of 1984 that will be shorter in duration. They won't be 20 minutes long in the jump room. They'll be about 8 minutes long. And the reason we were given for that 12-minute difference, where we'd actually be in the jump room going to Mars for a shorter duration, was that Mars was drawing very close to the Earth in its two-year orbit. And by May of 1984, it would be very close to Earth. Okay, now that could only be possible if the place they were sending us was the terrestrial planetary Mars. Okay, and I found that very convincing. And I was, but at the same time, I had listened to Bernard Mendez's account, both personally and on your show, for example. And Bernie was raising a lot of good counter arguments in supporting the notion that we were, in fact, accessing some sort of planetary hologram or synthetic quantum environment, as I coined the expression.
Like it was a field test.
Like the jump room wasn't taking us to Mars, but to a niche in time-space that, let's say, had been architected by the gray extraterrestrials. Bernie had stated that the U.S. astronauts, as distinguished from those of us who served as chrononauts, were aware of, and that they had a technical name for these SQEs, these niches in time-space. They were calling them slots. That it hadn't really been revealed to the people of the world that not just the conventional planets in space, but some sort of quantum augmentations had been discovered by the U.S. space program. In other words, not just the astronomical reality of the near-Earth environment, but some sort of superluminal holographic superimposition in our solar system had been detected. In fact, Bernie claims that by the time he left the service of the U.S. government, the U.S. government had detected 153 of these synthetic quantum environments, both under the Earth, on the surface of the Earth, which may explain a lot of this practice of keeping hundreds and thousands of miles of, for example, terrain in the United States off-limit to civilians. Bernie's position being that it's possible that that's keeping people away from some of these synthetic environments that the grays have constructed on the surface of the Earth, and also in outer space, going not all the way to, you know, a million miles to Mars, but perhaps as far as 400 miles away from our planet. Now, the counter arguments that Bernard raised, I found, were equally persuasive. For example, he was saying, look, NASA may be lying to us on atmospheric pressure. Of course, Brett raised the point that for the atmospheric pressure of Mars to be 8 millibars, which is NASA's position, parachutes the size of the continental United States would have had to have been used to deliver the rover's Spirit, Opportunity, and Curiosity to the surface of Mars. So that has to be a gross underestimate of atmospheric pressure on the surface of Mars. But Bernard said, well, independent scientists have arrived at the temperature extremes, which go 250 degrees less than 0 degrees Fahrenheit and 250 degrees higher than 0 degrees Fahrenheit. And also that they can also test independently the deficient oxygen supply on Mars, that those two factors make Mars not conducive to unprotected human life, which is our accounts were of going up there in our t-shirts and dungarees. We did not have specialized equipment. Initially, I was given a respirator, but I was in my street clothes on those jumps, maybe with some hiking boots. But typically in a polo shirt or a t-shirt and some blue jeans. Bernard also stated, and my investigation to where Mars physically was during those years supported his claim, that Mars was not in the right position when we first began jumping. It was way too far away and not in a convenient location relative to Earth. And then there were several very bizarre things that happened when we were jumping. Let me just describe the second one. It's what Bernard was talking about when you ended with him during your last interview. He was describing it as a causal loop that occurred. So let me describe that as sort of the best evidence in support of Bernie's position that we weren't going to the actual Mars, but we were going to a synthetic quantum environment. What happened was we went up in May of 84, and I remember that jump well because my late father had wanted to go up to Mars. He was still employed by the Ralph M. Parsons Company. He would retire later in 1984. He had heart disease, and as a ramification of that, he had impeded pulmonary performance. So he had not been medically approved to enter the jump room with its restricted oxygen environment and also the extremely stressful pressures of taking the jump room from Earth to wherever we were being sent, whether it was Mars or some synthetic environment. But then because the time in the jump room shortened in 1984 to 8 minutes, because Mars had drawn near to Earth, my father was approved to go up with us. The mission that he was given, and basically the rationale to give him an opportunity to be sent there, was to inspect aluminum, or aluminium, as we would say in the Antipodes, aluminium sheets that were placed as ramparts on the side of elevated roads that would create a slick surface so that predators in lower areas couldn't scamper up onto the roadways and challenge us or bite us or kill us, which is what we had been trained. Some of the animals on Mars were capable of doing and had done to our personnel. In fact, when Brett and Bernie and I were trained, Ed Dames gave us a grievous statistic. He said, of the 97,000 people we have so far sent to Mars, only 7,000 have survived after 5 years. And that was a direct quote that Brett recalled and I support. That's exactly what Dames stated. So there was this ongoing, very clear and present danger of predators on the surface of wherever they were sending us, whether it was Mars or a synthetic Mars. So the engineers of the Ralph M. Parsons Company had designed these aluminium sheets to place on the side of roads so that we would be protected in these elevated roadways. Now, we were walking in a group along one of those roadways back to the jump room that we called the corkscrew, presumably to, let's say, allow my dad to go home first. Because, again, he was medically compromised and we were concerned for his, you know, his medical or biological response to the stress of engaging in one of these jumps to a non-Earth environment. And we were walking along. I was walking point. Immediately behind me was Courtney Hunt of the CIA. If you can imagine somebody who looked like a cross between Richard Helms and Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, kind of the cigarette-smoking man from the CIA with the lined face. And then my dad was walking behind Courtney. And then Bernie Mendez and then Brett Stillings.
Oh, hold on. Bernie Mendez, Brett Stillings. I think we'll finish this list when we get back from the break with Andrew Bishago. The Chrononaut, Project Pegasus. Is it .org or .com?
Projectpegasus.net.
It's .net. Projectpegasus.net, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with Andy. Please don't desert me. This is an appropriate song. Turn it up.
What is about? There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
I'm Dirty Dirty. Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Get on your Facebook and your Twitter and your eugenics.com and get this show out to everybody. All right, there are so many archives on the Vinny Eastwood Show.com that are all free, you wouldn't believe. please get it out to people. Give the gift of information this Christmas. And I want to say a Merry Christmas and a very special thank you to the people who've been contributing to this show, whether by donations or subscriptions, and urge people to give generously this Christmas to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Got to pay the bills. Got to keep exposing Scumbag around. And I don't think I really need any new equipment there, so we'll be right. But please, give generously, because we bring people like Andy Bishago to you. You know, no cost. He's donating his time for free. I'm giving you a penny, am I, Andy? Sorry. All right. Now, anyway, so you're walking along Mars, and you had a bunch of people with you. Continue.
Right. Right. Courtney Hunt, my father, William Stilling, possibly Brett's father, Tom. I don't know. I'd have to check with Brett. Clearly, Bernard Mendez was with us on that trip. And then as we later pieced it together, what happened is a middle-aged woman and a 16-year-old boy suddenly were added to our group. They had not been on that mission, and we did not know who they were, but they were just sort of dropped in behind us by something while we were walking along, and my dad was inspecting these aluminum panels that had been placed as sort of ramparts to protect the roadway from predators scampering up to the roadway from below. And as we were walking along, we heard the boy at the end of the line there yell, "Wee," as if he was in a playground or something, and jump down one of the aluminum panels and then run around. He ran up onto this ancient stage-like artifact, and he was throwing his fists in the air like he was Rocky Balboa and in Rocky. And then we called out to him because he initially didn't see that over on our right, one of the vicious predators, one of those that you could not outrun ultimately, had scampered into position. This thing was like the other most dangerous predators, about 16 feet tall. And the best way I can describe it is it looked like a Tyrannosaurus rex with a more narrow head, but with a full lower face of teeth, and more of a supple sort of velociraptor body, as depicted, let's say, in Jurassic Park. And
sounds kind of like an Allosaurus.
Yeah, a small, intelligent dinosaur, and with stronger lower legs and sort of vestigial upper legs, but still, I mean, upper arms, but certainly hands and arms that it could use on its two forward limbs, or higher limbs, as it were. So that creature ran him ragged, because one thing we had been trained to do, and whoever this individual was, he began following our training, which was another mystery, because he wasn't in our class or even in our program. He began basically running in zigzag patterns as we had been trained. When in the immediate proximity of one of these predators that we could not outrun, their reaction times were known to be such that we were encouraged to essentially bide our time by running in a chaotic zigzag pattern. Ultimately, this young man became exhausted. He sat down on the ground below us, and the creature came over and bit him in the stomach, and he laid over on his side in a fetal position. When I say stomach, I mean it basically snapped around his midsection with its mouth full of huge, sharp teeth. And so the boy was not killed by that, but was grievously wounded, and he toppled over on his side in sort of a fetal position as we watched his viscera basically pour out onto the ground. And we all remember, or we later compared notes, that the woman began saying things like, she knew his name, for one thing. She began yelling, "Be strong, David. You'll soon be with the Lord. Your suffering will soon end, son." Which I'm not sure that you should really counsel a person whose life is slipping away moment by moment when they're in intense agony. But so that seems kind of strange for her to be sort of counseling him spiritually during his final moments. So what we then did is we left his body down there in that ravine, if you will, that shallow area to the right side of the roadway. We went back to the corkscrew, and we went back in groups of two and three, because because of the 8-minute time differential rather than the 20 minutes we had originally been taking to get between Earth and Mars and back, we could have three individuals in the jump room. So we got home a little bit quicker. Now, when we were in the lunchroom back at 999 North Sepulveda Boulevard in El Segundo, California, which is the building where the jump room was literally the elevator of that building, there was kind of a down room, kind of a lunchroom where we could just have a cup of coffee with our colleagues or whatever. And a discussion began as to whether we should go back and try to see if, in fact, he was still alive, and if not, retrieve his body, and if he was still alive, perhaps save his life, because essentially we became guilt-ridden that maybe he was just grievously wounded and had not yet died, and that we should really go back and check, really find a way to get down there and get his body and or somehow try to pull his body up and bring it home. So we all jumped back again in groups of threes, and we reconnoitered around the corkscrew, and then we walked down the road to his location. But as we did so, as we jumped back to Mars, something very anomalous happened. Instead of having new experience where we found ourselves going to get his body, we had the causal loop that Bernie was trying to explain on his last appearance on your show. It's a very convoluted story, but it was a very anomalous event. So instead of having new experience after that jump back to the surface, essentially what happened is everything started over again. In other words, arriving there the first time, walking down the road, watching my dad as he inspected the aluminum ramparts, the boy yelling something and then jumping down and parading around down there like Rocky Balboa. Essentially, everything that had happened that had led to the boy's death or serious injury and our return to the jump room and our jump home repeated itself. And yet it repeated itself with the same things occurring, but I remember not just having a sense of deja vu, but literally knowing inside of that causal loop that what I was experiencing is what we had all just experienced. So it was a repeat of that original jump in all of its many splendor detail with the tacit consciousness of knowing it was a repeat. In other words, it was a deja vu experience that was being extended for minutes, whatever it was, 15 minutes, a half hour. And we then, everything happened over again.
Like a daylight hallucination, daylight deja vu.
Yeah, everything happened over again. And so we didn't really make a new decision or take new action to retrieve his body or to try to find a way to drag him up to the road in a seriously wounded condition. Instead, he ended up getting bitten again, and we ended up, the woman yelled the same things to him, but when she was yelling, "Be strong, David, you'll soon be with the Lord," and the kind of admonitions that she was yelling down to him, I thought, she just did that. I'm recognizing this. Everything that's happening, we've done before. I think I even said to Courtney Hunt, I kind of whispered to Courtney, "This just all happened again," and he said something like, "I know." So some of the other people in our party were aware that essentially, this fold in the universe, wherever we had been sent, had sort of had a crimp in it, and we were now experiencing the same cosmic event scenario. So we then returned again, this time repeating our action to go back to El Segundo, but when we were at the lunchroom again, it was sort of like in an Alfred Hitchcock movie. You know, we could have been jurors who realized that they had just done their deliberation over again and said the same things or something. We actually caucused on what had just happened. And we said, wait a minute, didn't we all just go up there a second time? Didn't we just re-experience what we had previously experienced? And everybody agreed that we had just had a repeat of what we had just done. Bernie then said, listen, this is weird enough for me. I agree with all of you. We just went back up there, and the same thing we had done during the first jump repeated itself on the second jump. And guess what? We didn't end up bringing him back alive in a serious condition, nor his body back in a deceased condition. We just basically caused a repeat of our first jump to occur again. Okay, so Bernie dropped out. He said, look, I'm not going back. I think this is dangerous enough not to try again. And then the woman invaded upon us, well, who among us would want the group to abandon us there? What if that young man is in fact unconscious but still alive? wouldn't any one of us want the group to go back to try to rescue him and bring him back to Earth? And we all kind of sheepishly agreed. And she said, also, this is a program that's focused on exploration. And now that we found that we didn't have a new set of experiences when we returned after a short period of time, let's go back and see if we can find an explanation for why our first jump repeated itself. And all of us, except Bernie, went back up and the event repeated itself again. So we had three jumps in this causal loop that Bernie was describing.
Okay. Well, Andy, we've come to the end of the first hour, so we want to start taking callers in the second hour, ladies and gentlemen. The number is 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. Call in, and we'll answer your calls after the break with Andy Bishago, the Chrononaut, from ProjectPegasus.net. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. I've been monitoring the Vinnie Eastwood social network on Skype a little bit, and the chat room at the vinnieeastwoodshow.com, and a number of different people independently have said that this show's gone really, really fast, and I can't believe we've gone a whole hour already. We've got a caller on the line. Hopefully you can just be patient for just a few minutes. Andy wanted to finish up a point about this particular experience and the time loop that they were having, that perhaps it might have in fact been a chronovisor mission. Is that about right, Andy?
Well, yeah, in harmonizing Brett's position that it was the planetary Mars and Bernie's equally persuasive evidence that we were entering some kind of hologram, I had always been cautioning all of the chrononauts to not refer to the jump room as teleportation to Mars, because we didn't know the provenance, the structure, nor the function of the jump rooms. Bernie claims that the jump rooms were given to the United States government by the gray extraterrestrials. None of us could describe how they were working, whereas I can give a passable explanation of how Tesla teleportation works. So I was advising the chrononauts who have come forward publicly, let's stop referring to this as teleportation. We don't know what the jump rooms were doing. Now, the premise that I've developed, that Bernard Mendez has endorsed, is that it could have been the planetary Mars, but that we weren't teleporting there, but we were going there via a form of chronovision that the U.S. government had developed, in which we were being holographically superimposed over the actual Mars, in the same way that I was doing chronovisor probes as a child in Project Pegasus. So
kind of like the danger room from X-Men or something like that, just a projected, a very real reality around you kind of thing.
I'm saying that, well, that was Bernie's position, that actually we were accessing an entirely synthetic reality. Mine is a middle position, saying, look, if where Earth was, and you know, Mars was relative to each other, was significant, and the time in the jump room was only 8 minutes rather than 20, that implies that the actual Mars was being visited somehow. But then again, these holographic effects suggest that the way that we were visiting Mars was not the way that, let's say, conventional rocketry would put us down on the surface of Mars, but as a holographic superimposition over the actual Mars. And I think that harmonizes all of the discrepant data and is probably what was happening. It's almost like saying, you know, putting a chronovisor, a propagated hologram through a wormhole, so to speak. They found a way to extend the holographic effects of chronovision to literally take us off planet and use it to interact with the actual Mars. So that's my explanation of that. I think harmonizes all the different discrepancies and is consistent with the very strong evidence that both William Stillings and Bernard Mendez marshaled to support their positions.
So let's say you really went there, or like you were seeing what was actually there,
right?
But you weren't technically there. You were kind of a representation of yourself, like a projection, but you could actually interact as though you were the projection.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, we're all made up of light anyway, so that we were placed down in the actual Martian environment but as a superluminal superimposition over that real terrestrial environment, yes. And that's consistent with a number of close encounter cases. For example, if you consult the Fatima Trilogy, which I brought into English from Portuguese, which is available from Anomalous Books, there's a similar effect described there, where a real place in time-space can project a superluminal holographic emission over another terrestrial domain, and the beings that are being superimposed in that manner can be seen by and can interact with the environment and the beings that are at the target location. So I think that's what was probably happening. They had developed a way to basically holographically project us to the actual Mars. Because if we weren't going to the actual Mars, there wouldn't have been any relevance of the time in the jump room becoming shorter by 12 minutes, by more than 50%, as Mars drew within 40% of the original distance that we had been jumping. So that had to mean that we were jumping to the actual Mars. But then how do you explain all these holographic effects and the anomaly of literally several team members being added to our team on the surface? Well, if a holographic technique was using, it looks like it was a holographic technique that was then being hijacked by some other advanced intelligence civilization on Mars or extraterrestrial.
To what purpose?
I don't know. Maybe that we had just attracted notice because we were some of the first Earthlings to be interacting with another planetary domain, terrestrial domain. I mean, but Bernie was the investigator. He can testify to both of the instances where something highly non-ordinary occurred involving some kind of superimposition in the reality that we were experiencing.
Okay. Well, how could you breathe on Mars? I mean, were you not kind of really, really there? Like for example, the physical things couldn't happen to you, but then how could the kid get eaten by a dinosaur if it wasn't real?
Yeah, Bernie verified that boy was not with our team, so he may have been just some kind of holographic simulation. The paradox of chronovision, and I've tried to articulate it in my public lectures and radio interviews where I've had the time to really explain these things. Chronovision is really paradoxical in the way it works. It has, when you visit a non-local location in time-space via chronovision, the experience has both physical and virtual effects. So, for example, I drank liquids when I was being chronovised to past locations, but I was assured by the program that if somebody took a saber and tried to slice me in half, that it would go right through me. So we were there in ways that had physical ramifications, but also ways in which the virtual aspect of holography was governing what was happening. So it's really a paradoxical way of relating to the universe where your presence in that non-local location has both physical and non-physical characteristics. So we were there. We were breathing the air that was in the environment of Mars at that time, at least as we were holographically being placed there.
Okay. And why are there why was there dinosaurs? You said that there was some kind of aluminium ramp or fence or something to keep the predators out?
In the lecture by Ed Dames, we had gone over 30 or more terrestrial species. They were actually very, very exquisitely illustrated, almost as John James Audubon used to illustrate birds. You know, Birds of America, for example, just some very talented graphic artist had drawn illustrations of the different animal species we would encounter or might encounter on the surface. About half of them were predators, and among those that were predators, several were simply too fast and too fierce to evade. I had been given really two things to carry on my trips, basically a photo flash type gun that could incinerate small animals at a considerable distance, and also a suicide pill, because the gun wouldn't work on the largest and most vicious predator species if I was cornered by one of them. So we actually had moral instruction and also to some extent just tactical instruction of what to do if, for example, we were cornered by one or the other type of species. So in one instance, we might want to fire our gun and incinerate the creature and evade. In another instance, the creature would be too big for the gun to really do anything but anger the creature, and we were urged basically to just sit down and and take our suicide pill. So we had instruction about what our options were if we were confronted by or cornered by the different types of animals. Some of them were entirely docile. Some were predators that we would be able to fire at and or outrun and kill, by the way. And we were given moral instruction as to whether we might want to be responsible for fomenting interplanetary war by firing a weapon on Mars. And that yet there were several species where even if we used our flash gun, we would not be able to kill them to protect ourselves. We would just anger them. And some of the most vicious predators were known to sort of play with their prey before finally killing it. Namely us, if we were unfortunate enough to be cornered by one of the inescapable predators.
So you're kind of like a dangerous mouse playing with a cat.
Right, right. If we fired our... The upshot was that if we set our setting on our gun to the far left, there were three settings, basically heat, stun, and kill. And the joke in the program was, if you're lighting somebody's cigarette on heat, do the right thing, namely turn the button to the far right to heat the edge of the gun to light their cigarette. Because if you set it for kill on the far left and then lean forward to light somebody's cigarette, you might incinerate their head off if you use the kill function to light their cigarette. You'd certainly probably burn their hand away. So that was a running joke in the program. Remember, if you light somebody's cigarette, do the right thing. So it had three settings. The stun feature was, let's say you were confronted by a creature about the size of a human being who might challenge a humanoid but could certainly be contested. In that instance, we might just kind of give it a little bit of a singe to scare it away, basically set it for stun, and try to hit it on the leg or on the side and just have it run away in pain. If we were trapped by one of the predators we could evade and kill with the gun, we were then given the moral, you know, the moral complexities of setting our gun for kill and then killing that predatory species, which nonetheless could be contested. But in the case of the very large, very fast, several species that could not be evaded in any way, we were instructed that it was probably a bad idea to set your gun for kill and try to kill one of those creatures because you would just make it angry.
Mm. So, okay.
Yeah. So.
Right. Well, we want to start taking callers. So, ladies and gentlemen, 218-339-8525 is the number to call in. Andy, do you have any final words to say before we go to our first caller?
No, just that. I think, you know, I was intentionally sitting on the fence because I think that Brett and Bernie were making some very good arguments in support of their positions. And I think now we've really resolved that that's probably what was going on. We were actually, you know, we were visiting the real Mars, but in some form of holography that periodically was getting hijacked by some non-human intelligence. We don't know who it was. It could have been the gray extraterrestrials. It could have been the most advanced Martian humanoids who are our relatives on Mars. They're the descendants of human beings from Earth who were placed on Mars by the previous Earth civilization that fell around 9500 BC during a solar system catastrophe that impacted both Earth and Mars. It could have been a foreign government on the Earth, but somebody was periodically hacking into the jump room experience and causing outcomes on the surface that were basically holographic. Might have been some higher level of advanced intelligence on Earth, but Bernie and I are certain that we didn't have a simple encounter with a consistent terrestrial environment. And yet, you know, when Mars drew near to Earth, our jump time was reduced in a concomitant way, which means we were actually visiting Mars. So that I think this resolves the controversy.
Okay. All right, well, let's go to our first caller now. I've been patiently waiting. Chris in Florida, you're on the air.
Hello?
Vin? Yep, you're on.
Andy? Hey.
Hi.
I was just wondering, Andrew, I saw you on Jesse Ventura's conspiracy theory after you guys did the last interview.
Right.
And I was wondering what you thought of the treatment, you know, like, was it a fair show? Was there anything that they omitted that, you know, maybe you wanted to talk about here? And I was also real curious about the space on Mars and Cydonia and, you know, what they thought about that at the time, if they were aware of it. And that's all I had. You know.
Well, I think that Jesse Ventura and his producers, Chris, are to be commended for their story selection. You know, they're in their third season, and they've covered a lot of material that simply has never been shown on mainstream television. And so I far be it from me to criticize really one of the populist political heroes of American history, at least certainly the more recent decades. I really like Jesse personally. He really has a heart of gold. He's not a brutal personality at all. He's a very intelligent and almost glowing personality. So he's just a very good guy, and I don't want to criticize him personally. I think the treatment I got on his show was fair but superficial. You know, even in that last scene where we went to the house that my father and I had stayed in White Rock, New Mexico, first summer of 1973, accessing it via teleportation from fall of 1971, and then the previous summer, summer of 72, we stayed there the second time. That was a very deep story. There were many other details that I could have shared with him. For example, I found both of the houses in that community of 2,000 residents that were owned by the space coordinator for the engineering department at the Los Alamos Labs, a man by the name of Marvin Linke. I validated that his wife was a school teacher, and that explains why they were making their homes available for summer sublets during those years, because they were traveling internationally. I went back in time and recovered the name of the realtor who handled the summer sublet. Her name was Mary Deal, because I recalled that my father had said, hey, that's a great name for a real estate agent, Deal, you know, for a realtor. So there were many, many details, including a linkage to Harold Agnew that I made with Mary's still alive, but I didn't have a chance to interview her, but I interviewed her husband and daughter. And the family were personal friends with Harold Agnew, who was literally the Federal Science Administrator for Project Pegasus. So that beyond just being able to identify in a way that I shouldn't have been able to, the rather odd interior floor plan of that woman's house, the fact, for example, that when you walk in the front door, there's a bedroom and then a kitchen on your immediate left, and other details I was showing with her. And she did state in the affirmative that we had never met. I had never been in her house. So for the 25 years she said she had lived there. I think that kind of embodies the superficiality of the show. But then again, I wouldn't fault Ventura and his producers. That really is the nature of mainstream television. There's not a lot of deep background investigation even before somebody's life story is presented. So all of the rich detail that I was able to gather over my 10-year investigation into what happened to me in childhood really didn't get even filmed, much less survive the final edit. The only objection that I have to the show, and I can't really explain why it occurred, is you may recall that at the end of the show, Jesse Ventura described me as a victim of what the U.S. government had done, of whatever they did. And that's certainly not what I am. I'm one of the first U.S. chrononauts, and I'm somebody who has successfully championed the public's right to know the truth that the U.S. government developed and was researching time travel during those years. I'm certainly a victim of the project in the sense that I wasn't paid, ultimately, for 7 years of work on behalf of the U.S. government, if you also include my jump from years. I was certainly physically...
Andy, we're coming up to a break, and I think that actually kind of really nicely answers some of those questions there. Chris in Florida, thank you very much for your call. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to call in the next segment, the number is 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525 at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about
Welcome
the
back.
Real fluoride in your water? What you know about
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. You know, it's December 21st, tomorrow in New Zealand. And I think the rest of you guys, you're going to wait another 2 days. So, you know, I'll be doing. I'm wondering Andy, whether or not I should do a show on the 21st or whether or not I just want to take that day off, I think I've got Zen Gardner on the show tomorrow. And you know what? I think I probably will, because it'd be fun to actually broadcast live on December 22nd from New Zealand to the United States when it's December 21st, the alleged and total hoax into the world. Just go, okay, guys, look, I've seen December 21st, and it ain't no different from December 20th.
Well, I know that the world doesn't end, because when I was serving as a child in Project Pegasus, aspects of my post-December 21st, 2012 existence were shown to me. So I haven't allowed myself to be bothered at all by sort of the conventional catastrophism that centers around that date. I think that's irrational. I think it's sort of like the millennial fever of 1844, where you may recall that people were standing on their roofs of their homes awaiting the return of Jesus Christ. I mean, there's no dispositive evidence that indicates that December 21st is going to be different than any other day. Certainly, the planetary alignment of 5/5/2000 didn't result in anything manifesting. The precession of the equinox apparently happens in the year 2118, not in 2012. So I'm not preparing for anything beyond just another day of existence and the beginning of the future.
You know, I'm preparing for a big party, Andy. And if anybody's listening, if you want to email me through the contact page of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, I'll send you my address if you're in Auckland, New Zealand tomorrow night. You know, come on round. Because look at it this way. If it is the end of the world, which it's not, it'd be great that you were hacking around with other conspiracy-minded people who can have really, really awesome conversations with. And on the other hand, isn't that just a great excuse anyway? You know, people use bad things as an excuse to be afraid, to get prepared and things like that. I see bad times as a time to celebrate what you're about to lose.
Well, there is a psychological out in the sense that by apprehending catastrophe, people are at least temporarily unburdened of the need to contemplate the future and the struggles and strains that it will inevitably entail. On the other hand, it's a poor way of motivating yourself to enjoy a better future, either personally or collectively.
Yeah,
but it does
psychologically. Push it up. I mean, if your energy levels are low, push them up. If your government sucks, push them out. I don't know what people have really got. You don't need a particular time or date to be a powerful, well-connected, and effective human being with a decent psychological profile and a big heart. You don't need a particular day to come. Time waits for no man. So why should any man wait for time to pass?
Exactly. But, you know, Vinny, moments do matter. So, for example, I'm motivating myself by envisioning the moment when I cut the red ribbon at Grand Central Teleport in New York City. So envisioning great moments that are worth living, that works. That's a good way to motivate yourself positively. As contrasted with adhering to an arbitrary date and time that's devoid of content. That's not a moment. That's some end state. Why would you apprehend some undesired end state? That just doesn't make sense.
Now, we have Bernie Mendez calling me. I'll just send his info to AFR and see if he wants to ring in and join us. Would you like that, Andy?
Sure, I just mentioned to Bernie when we were on here. That's why I actually referenced him that I was still on with you, because I see that he had contacted me over Skype. So have at it if you'd like.
Okay. Well, AFR, if you can get that contact info sorted and bring Bernie up, I've sent it right to you. Should be all good. He should be coming up soon enough. Now, the other aspect of this is a lot of people. They'll talk about you, Andy, as if you're the only one who was part of the project, and they kind of blackball you, you know, do the whole ad hominem argument. You're not the only one who was there. You're not the only one talking about it. I mean, come on. You know, people don't collectively hallucinate the exact same thing in the exact same period of time.
That's correct. In fact, we have six whistleblowers, five of whom were jumpers, one of whom was asked to jump with her children, and we're developing a seventh whistleblower who is a distinguished person. So basically, in order of public revelation, there was Michael C. Ralph, myself, Arthur Neumann, who was the Henry Deacon informant to Project Camelot, William B. Stillings, and then Laura Eisenhower described how she was subjected to a recruitment to go to the Mars colony in 2006 and 7 with her twin boys, and then Bernard Mendez. So there's six informants telling the same story. And by the way, I've resolved with Laura that when she was being told she and her sons were going to go to Mars via ARC, I think, again, they were referring to the jump rooms, the idea being that if you wanted to relocate a large group of human beings in a time-urgent way on Mars, you could have people just streaming through the jump rooms. Okay, so I think the ARCs were the jump rooms themselves. That was a metaphor for saving humanity or a large part of the biodiversity on Earth by jump-rooming human beings to another planet. That bespeaks what actually the jump rooms were doing, if in fact it was a holographic effect of some kind. Now, Laura and I are going to be developing a seventh whistleblower. So again, when you have these people who are roughly members of the baby boom generation in the 13thers, and they had a similar set of experiences focused on the same training officers, the same locations. I mean, William Stillings, Bernard Mendez, and myself were trained together. Okay, we met in the summer of 1980 before we ever saw one of the jump rooms. That, I think, is persuasive. I mean, if you were trying to establish that somebody had served in the military and you were capable of finding three testifying witnesses who were in their military unit, that could be used in any court of law in the Anglo-American jurisprudential system of justice throughout the whole world. Okay, so we have three individuals who were trained and on the surface of Mars together. We've got Michael's original account, and then we've got Arthur, and then Laura as a member of a U.S. presidential family coming forward. Look at how infrequently the descendants of U.S. presidents ever even comment on matters of public interest. We've had what? We had Amy Carter opposing apartheid and climbing over the fence at one of the nuclear facilities. But generally speaking, the children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren of U.S. presidents have avoided commenting on the affairs of the day because they don't want to be viewed as attempting to claim political currency merely as a result of the genetic accident of having been genetically descended from a U.S. president. So Laura has been exceptional as a member of the Eisenhower family in coming forward and saying, look, these guys are telling the truth because in 2006 and 7, I was asked to go to Mars with my boys to settle there. I mean, why would somebody from a presidential family tell a tale that tall? Yeah, that's a bit of a tongue twister. But why would somebody...
The tall tale, tongue-twisting, triangular vernacular.
Yeah, right. So why... It's late in the year. But why would Laura be telling a tall tale and risk the currency or the credibility she would have as an Eisenhower to talk about other matters of public interest? It just doesn't make sense.
It's a good question. And we have a caller on the line here. I think it might be Bernie. Is that you, Bernie?
Yes, it's me. Can you hear me? Over.
Oh, yeah. Roger. How are you, Bernie?
Not too bad. Sorry I joined a little late. Been very busy today. Had a lot of legal issues to get by.
Yeah. There just is never enough time in the day, is there?
I'm out of a job, in case anybody's interested.
Hey, all right. Well, what have we been discussing here earlier in the show, Bernie, is Andrew has been laying out these different possibilities about the chronovisors and the gray aliens and that kind of thing, which was responsible for this this Mars jump that you guys did, where you had a bit of a repeat experience, like a deja vu, and then you refused to go on a following jump. was wondering if you had anything to add onto that gravy train there.
Yes, I'm here to support Andrew. Andrew kind of persuaded me to step forward, and a lot of reservations, losing my job being one of them now. But I think he's doing a really good thing. My website's BernardMendez.com. That particular jump was what they called a loop. We were in some kind of loop. There were at least three jumps made, and the same thing, it repeated over and over again. And we don't know who this boy was. When I, the jump that Brett made ahead of me, they came back, and then I think it was the dames called me over and said, "We have a problem. Someone's back there." I says, "Now," I said, "how many people jumped?" He said, "Four people jumped and four people came back." And who's left behind? Says, "We don't know. Apparently it was an incident where some boy got mauled by a creature." So when I made the jump right after that, we didn't see anything. It was by the ramp. We had built a ramp because the creatures can't go up the ramp. And we were testing the ramp to make sure it was going to be stable. So they had put this corrugated tin on the side of the ramp. So if the ramp started collapsing, we would notice that the corrugated tin would, you know, fall apart on the side of the ramp. So we were testing that ramp, and someplace off to the right of that ramp, down in an area on off to the right of it somehow, where this kid got mauled. So when I went up there, we didn't see anything, and I'd walked up the ramp because they wanted me to check the ramp when I was up there to make sure it was stable. But on the way back, when we came back and we were down at the bottom of the ramp and we were walking back towards the jump room, is when this boy popped out of nowhere. He turned around and he walked up the ramp. And before I could say anything, because I didn't notice him right away, he was like behind us. He slid down, went into this area, and this whole scenario happened over again in just about the same fashion. We never identified exactly who he was. So I said, this happened. From the briefing I got before that, it seemed to have happened exactly the same way. So what I said, before we go down there and do anything, let's jump back and let's get some more help here and find out what the hell's going on. Because he wasn't part of our group as we jumped there. So when I went back, I told the personnel that were there, I said, the same thing happened. This boy slid down the side of the ramp, and he got mauled by one of these creatures. He's running around in a particular manner, a manner we were trained to run in, like, semicircles, because the creatures couldn't turn around very easily. And apparently he got mauled again, and I said, I don't know what's going on. I said, who is this person that's up there? So the amount of people that jumped with me and jumped back were the same. So this additional person, whoever he was, and I never have been able to identify who he was. And this thing happened again. So, and then from there, we were all standing around discussing all this. And I said, well, this happened to you, this happened to you. And there were names being dropped as to who this person was, but this person wasn't in the program. So I really didn't know what to do. So I think I left the area at that time. But I think another jump was made after that. And I think the same thing happened again. Now, when I came back, because I went over and I was talking to someone else, I had a procedure I had to follow. And when I came back, and everyone was sitting around, was mulling around, trying to figure out what the hell was going on, another jump was made, and apparently the same identical thing happened again. I said, make sure you count the people that leave and the people that come back, you know, who left and who came back, the exact number of people who left came back. And apparently it happened again. Andrew, what do you think?
I think you've given a description that pretty much follows mine. I know that I was in the front of the group, and immediately behind me was Courtney Maurice Hunt of the CIA, and then my dad. And I was keeping a close eye on my dad because of his cardiac and pulmonary issues. And then I know you were toward the back of our original or sort of authentic cadre. Wasn't Brett on that jump as well? I kind of remember Brett being there, but maybe I've superimposed that because of Brett was rather youthful and similar in nature to the blonde boy who then appeared. But there was also that woman who was sort of a Christer. I mean, she was always sort of dropping Jesus' name in every other sentence. Now, was she a member of our group? Because I didn't recognize her. Wasn't she another sort of holographic augmentation of our original cadre that was on that sortie on the surface?
That woman was a person, and I had reservations before we made the jump. I said, they were sitting over having coffee, and I said, let's go get briefed about the last few jumps and where we're going. I knew where we were going anyway. But I always have the procedure, we're going to have brief and debrief. And then we'll talk about the jumps, any problems, you know, anything that we'd be wary about. And then she was sitting there at the table, says, we're going to sit here and we're going to pray. So I says, you know, this is not our procedure. Go ahead.
Hey, Bernie, we're coming to break here. did you want to hang on over the break, or you're all good, mate?
I'll hang here.
All right. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Bernard Mendez and Andrew Bushango. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Final segment here on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. It's for freaking sure, mate. And we have Bernard Mendez, UFOQA.com, and I believe also BernardMendez.com, and Andrew Bushango from ProjectPegasus.net. Gentlemen, welcome back. I don't know where we're going to go with this. We've got one final segment, and when each of you starts speaking, it tends to take up 2 hours. So what exactly can we squeeze in that's of great importance to either of you?
Well, I think it's significant, Vinny, that we've got three individuals living in different parts of the country. I mean, I live in Washington State, where I practice law. Brett is an inventor and computer specialist residing in Southern California. And Bernard Mendez lives in New York City, that we're from different backgrounds, but we're adhering to our claim that we worked together in this secret defense project 30 years ago, and that we're now in communication and have become not just colleagues, but friends now. And we're standing by each other's accounts, because the people have a right to know the different forms of space exploration that the United States government has conducted, and they include different forays in time-space embodied in different time travel technologies. And this was a project that was undertaken in furtherance of the NASA Act. You know, the original enabling legislation for the U.S. Space Agency in 1958 stated that the primary goal of the space agency was the expansion of human knowledge of space and the near-Earth environment. Well, this is exactly what this was. We were either going to the actual Mars holographically, or we were accessing a synthetic quantum environment that must have been in space rather than under or on the surface of the ground of the Earth in terms of the SQE concept, because we were frequently in the jump room for 20 minutes. And, you know, I really am grateful to Bernard and William for coming forward, because I was really out on my own in terms of talking about Project Pegasus, because when I was serving as a child in Project Pegasus, most of the people that I was interacting with were mid-career professionals, roughly 45 to 65 years of age, including some of the Manhattan Project physicists. Well, so almost all of the adult participants in Project Pegasus are either deceased or very elderly. But in the case of the Jump Room program, which was 10 years later in the early 80s, we have three adults who not only served together, but were trained together. And we remain in solidarity over the fact that the program existed and that it involved a time travel technology and that we were part of it. So I think it's a story that's not going to go away when you also factor in that during the entire time that Barack Obama has been president, and there's been this sort of superficial controversy about whether he was born in Kenya or Hawaii, The truth of this particular man is that he was a participant in a secret space program project that took he and us off planet. And I think that's part of the history of our time that needs to be told. And look, now that President Obama has been reelected, I'm going to continue to speak as openly and truthfully and as often as I can to link him to the program, not really to focus on him, because after all, he was just another jumper who went on to an illustrious career, as a number of us did. So it wasn't all about Barack Obama, but the fact that he served in the secret space program is part of the history of the U.S. presidency and the times that we're living in. And so the story is simply not going to go away.
Bernie, anything to add?
I believe that I didn't. First of all, when Andrew first talked to me, and Andrew was the only one talking to me, but at least five or six other people had talked to me and had requested access to the information, which had been, some of it's been declassified and then reworked and reclassified. You know, I had reservations about it all, but I didn't ever believe in my lifetime, because I was told never to talk about it, that these matters would ever come to light. And apparently, there's more and more witnesses in the wings. Even George Knapp is starting to get suspicious that maybe there's something really to this. Even our critics are being silenced. This is a very big affair. Should it continue at this pace to prove out, which someday it will. I know that for a fact. Well, over my lifetime, that's another story. But I don't know if you want to continue with the different jumps and what had happened, or you just want to continue with talking about the project in general. Which would you prefer?
You know, for me, there's also a philosophical aspect to this, because it's not just a technical thing that was being done during these experiments. Have you guys learned any kind of lessons about maybe life or the nature of reality itself that are really quite profound by this experience?
You want to go first, Andrew? Or should I go first?
Well, you know, we were brainwashed after our training in the summer of 80 and then before our last jump in 1984. So one of the philosophical dimensions of this kind of experience, perhaps one of just the cognitive things, let me start there, is that when you have a life experience that is singular or very, very stressful, even traumatic, and the trauma is reinforced by the kind of brainwashing that was available, let's say, from the Reagan years forward, which was already going on 20 years after MK Ultra ended, you can compartmentalize life experience so that you simply do not revisit in your mind for decades. Now, that didn't happen to me with my childhood experiences in Project Pegasus, because when they were inducing this hideous headache and speaking to me in a mesmerizing voice in spring of 72, or end of summer of 72, to try to get me to suppress my memories of Pegasus, that didn't work. And I was periodically mentioning something about Pegasus to my junior high school, college, and graduate and law school classmates and friends. And that's why I was really focusing on my experiences in Pegasus when I began going back and revisiting my non-ordinary experiences roughly from around the year 2000. But in the case of the Jump Room program, if Brett hadn't evinced the personal courage to contact me, and then if our dialogue had not been augmented and improved by Bernie stepping forward and communicating with us, a lot of this information would have remained trapped in areas of our minds that were not accessible to ourselves. So I think it's safe to say that it's relatively easy to suppress the memory of a single person, but it's far more difficult to suppress the memories of a group of people who experienced things in common, who shared common experience. And so because memory is so fickle and so ineffective, since memory is so imperfect, I think that in society in general, but certainly in the counterculture, if you will, the cultural creative demographic where we explore these kind of issues, we have to exercise what I'm basically describing simply as the principle of tolerance. Because look, everybody's experience is germane only to them. and we don't even understand at this point whether the universe exists and we perceive it, or the universe exists because we perceive it, which is, of course, the Einstein-Heisenberg dilemma. So what I'm saying here is, if somebody like myself, who's a hard-headed realist, I'm a trial lawyer, I earned degrees from universities as distinguished as UCLA and Cambridge, I have been screened psychologically to be admitted to numerous state bar examinations, I have no arrest record, no history of drug or alcohol abuse. And Bernie's a similar personality. We're very hard-boiled, realistic personalities. If we could come forward and allege this set of facts, then we have to practice a principle of toleration, of open-mindedness. Because even in the lives of hard-boiled public servants like ourselves, this information was not easy for us to extract from where it existed in our minds as a result of the original non-ordinary nature of the experiences, the trauma, and the brainwashing that was done against us. So,
well, here's another element that I was just thinking about yesterday, Andrew, is that people say, oh, show me the evidence, show me the evidence. If somebody is on trial and they testify that, yes, I saw that criminal breaking into that car and it looks exactly like this person in the courtroom here, testimony is evidence.
Well, actually, to amplify or clarify, individuals are free to testify directly in live testimony in a written form subject to an attestation of their oath that they're telling the truth. But witnesses can testify in live testimony as to what they did or what they saw, and that is direct evidence. In fact, probably at least 50% of the evidence that's used to convict people of crimes is such live testimony embodying direct evidence of some witness or participant. I saw that man over across in the courtroom robbing the bank. So for example, and that knocks down the frequent phony or fallacious argument that when you're alleging non-ordinary facts, you're engaging in hearsay. I mean, hearsay is an out-of-court statement offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. It's a statement of a statement that's been made. It's not direct testimony of that which was perceived. That's critical. So, yes, personal accounts are admissible as direct evidence.
Yeah. All right. And we've got Bernard Mendez, Andrew Brashago. Gentlemen, welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show. I don't know why I said welcome. Just very, very tired. Didn't have a whole lot of sleep. And, you know, I got to say this. If people are really testifying, like really, first-hand accounts, witness evidence, things like that, it doesn't matter how insane the story sounds. You've got to listen to them and take them as if it were a piece of physical evidence like DNA or any other kind of evidence. It has virtually the same value. And if people are corroborating, people are saying the same things, it's got to be true. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.